Call to order the Government Operations Reform Technology and Elections Committee. First bill on the agenda is House File 160, Representative Hilty. Representative Hilty.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I do have an amendment to the bill that is.
Representative Hilty, why don't you move your bill first and get it before us, and then in your motion, let us know where it's going to go.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 160 to be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on State Government Finance.
All right. And then is the A1 amendment yours?
Yes, it is.
Excuse me, Representative Hilty. Representative Hilty, I've been told that this could go directly to finance. Does it need to go to state government finance?
Mr. Chair, your guess is as good as mine.
Representative Hilty, it's my understanding it went to finance originally, so why don't you amend your motion to have it go to finance?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, I would be happy to do that. So it would be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
All right, and then you have the A1 amendment?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you move the amendment?
Move the A1 amendment.
Representative Hilty moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The bill is amended. So, Representative Hilty, why don't you explain your bill as amended?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, basically, the amendment is the bill. It's really only a single sentence, which authorizes the Secretary of State, after appropriate notice, written notice to the Commissioner of Finance and chairs of the relevant committees, to move some of the HABA funds that were dedicated to certain purposes when the funds were initially allocated to be used to for other purposes. The situation, Mr. Chair, members, is that back when these funds were allocated by the legislature to the Secretary of State, there was concern, I think it's fair to say, primarily from local units of government about how these funds would be used and how it would be allocated and for what purpose. So instead of just making a blanket allocation and leaving it up to the Secretary to make that division, certain uses were specified. The problem was that it was very difficult to anticipate how much any of these various allocations would actually end up using or needing. For instance, $120,000 was allocated to process complaints under the HABA statutes, but in fact there were no complaints. So that's probably the prime instance of this. But as far as the particulars about how much money remains or what uses would be put to, we have Beth Fraser from the Office of the Secretary of State that can answer questions.
Right. Ms. Fraser, welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Beth Fraser, and I'm the Director of Governmental Affairs for the Secretary of State's office. And thank you for taking the time to look at this bill and for doing so early in the session. It's important to pass this bill as early in the session as possible because it just deals with the fiscal year 07 budget. So we're talking about funds that the office has available between now and the end of June of this year. As Representative Hilty explained, the legislature was very prescriptive when they allocated the Help America Vote Act funds to us. And as the budget was handed to us a few weeks ago, we found that there was no money remaining in some of the categories where actually quite a bit of work needs to be done, and quite a bit of money remaining in other categories where there's not a good use of the funds within the next 5.5 months. Now, it's a different story once we get to the 08-09 budget. At that point, we will want to spend significant funds in the categories that we're looking at moving the money from at this point. We will want to spend adequate funds on training local election officials and educating the public about the new accessible machines. We also, when we look at the 08-09 budget, we'll want to look at what we need to do to fully comply with the Help America Vote Act. One of the things we've heard from the counties again and again is that the statewide voter registration system, which is this huge database that every registered voter in the state is in, has great potential and will be wonderful when it's done, but that right now there are still lots of problems. It's very slow at peak periods. It's hard to use the absentee ballot function, at least when during peak periods. There are problems with the Department of Public Safety's new driver's license numbers and how we're doing matches now that there are two numbers on record, or somebody might have written down the old number and the new numbers in the system. There was also a problem with the election night reporting system on primary night, and there was kind of a patch done for general election night. But basically, fixing the statewide voter registration system is our top priority, and from the county's perspective, their top priority. What they've said for 08-09 is that they want us to first fix the statewide voter registration system. If there's money left over, they would be interested in getting it to help defray some of their costs. So we'll be looking at that 08-09. This is 07. So at this point, what we want to do is move the funds from some of the categories where there's not a logical use over the next 5.5 months to continue our work on the statewide voter registration system. So, for example, we have $145,000 left to assist local election officials in using the system. And if you're looking at the chart on the second page, there's, I think, $110,000 for training local election officials on use of the new disabled equipment. And those, there's not a lot of use for training between now and the end of June. The time for doing that would have been prior to the election. Similarly, as Representative Hilty mentioned, $120,000 in the pot just to deal with complaints under the Help America Vote Act. We had so few of those, we haven't touched any of this money. We're not expecting many, if any, complaints in the next 5.5 months. We'd like to be able to access this for what really needs to be worked on in the next 5.5 months, which is working on the statewide voter registration system.
Representative Hilty, is there anyone else who is testifying on your bill, for or against? Is there anyone here today who wishes to testify for or against the bill? Please. Come on up. Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Carol Peterson, and I work at Washington County in Stillwater, Minnesota. And I am here in support of this bill. A couple of weeks ago, we had our winter conference with the MACO organization, Minnesota Association of County Officers, and we did have a motion to support this bill at that time. So I just wanted to convey that information to you.
Thank you. I believe there's a clipboard up there, too. We may want to have you sign
okay.
in, too.
Okay, so. I will do that.
Does anyone have any questions for Ms. Peterson? Thank you for coming today.
You're welcome.
Anyone else who wishes to testify? Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing no questions, then Representative Hilty renews his motion that House File 160 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Finance Committee as amended. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any negative, please say nay. The motion prevails and the bill is on its way.
Thank you,
Representative Hilty. The next bill we have is House File 110. Representative Huntley, I saw him here. There he is. Representative Huntley, does this bill go to the floor, or does it have to go to another committee?
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding it can go to the floor.
It can go
to the Environment Policy Committee. There's no real fiscal note.
All right. Representative Huntley, I'm going to move House File 110, but before I do that, would there be any disagreement on the committee that we would move it to the consent calendar? It appears to be a bill that has been worked on since 1999. There is total agreement on it. I don't. Representative House.
I would rather hear his testimony.
Once we
hear about the bill, then that might be a good idea.
All right. Then the initial motion will be for House File 110 to be passed and be sent to General Register. So, Representative Huntley, please present your bill.
Mr. Chairman and members, this is a governor's initiative. It's called the Great Lakes Compact. As you said, they started these discussions in, I believe, 99. And it involves a compact between the eight states that surround the Great Lakes, plus the two provinces, Ontario and Quebec. This particular thing we're doing today relates just to the U.S. side, but parallel to this, there is an agreement being developed that does exactly the same thing for the two Canadian provinces, and then with the United States, it's very complex to that obviously has to go through the State Department. And so what this is aimed primarily at diversions out of the Great Lakes Basin, moving water out of the Great Lakes and to prevent that. As I said, and you referenced, it's been under discussion for 9 years. About December 2005, it was approved by the eight Great Lakes governors and the two premiers of the two provinces in Canada. And now it has to be passed by each of the eight states, then approved by Congress. And then, in addition to that, there's the parallel thing going on between the two provinces of Canada and the United States. The issues are that if you divert water, and if you look, you all have a copy of this? If you look at various places, the Great Lakes Basin is actually not as far from the Great Lakes as you might think. In fact, if you look at Lake Michigan, the basin in the southeastern part down around Illinois and the southern part of Wisconsin is only a couple miles wide. So if you take, and there's actually one of the things that brought this to a head was a suburb of Milwaukee wished to get its drinking water out of Lake Michigan, but then run its sewer system a little bit further to the west, and that puts it out of the Great Lakes Basin and into ultimately into the Mississippi River. There are many of these diversions already in place. Only about three of them are very significant, and everything that is grandfathered in, so there won't be any changes to anything that's in place. The main one out is in the city of Chicago. There used to be a river that ran into the Great Lakes, and now it runs out of the Great Lakes down into the Mississippi, and that's a very significant loss of water that is grandfathered in, and I will say that is causing huge problems for the environment today because Some of you are aware of the Asian carp, and they're swimming up the Mississippi, and they're getting very close to the Great Lakes. And if they swim up that river, get into the Great Lakes, it will devastate the fishing in the Great Lakes. There's currently a barrier, but that just is an example of what happens when you mess around with Mother Nature, I guess. The interesting thing, I'm very interested in shipping, of course, being from Duluth, and the water level's at about 100-year low right now, which greatly affects the shipping industry. But there happens to be two diversions of water out of the Hudson Bay basin into the Great Lakes that almost compensate for what's going out in Chicago. So the net is pretty even. But this treaty or compact would prevent any major diversions in the future. It's been under negotiation for at least 5 years between the eight states, and it prevents any other major diversions. It does allow water to go out to some degree for what's called consumptive uses. This could be into power plants that may evaporate it, and it also allows some water to go out to be marketed either as beverages or as water, but those are pretty minimal. Everything in this compact is less strict than what we already have in Minnesota law. So there, what this compact will do is force basically the other seven Great Lakes states to catch up with where Minnesota is today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ken Lockesmo from the Department of Natural Resources. But let me emphasize again that this has been signed by all the eight governors, including our governor, and it is an initiative of the Council of Great Lakes Governors.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kent Lockesmo, I'm the Director of the Division of Waters for DNR. And I've been involved with this process for a great number of years. And as Representative Huntley said, this is a compact. It's an agreement between the eight states. And I may just quickly walk through the handout that you had entitled the Great Lakes Compact. This deals with two water issues. One is diversions out of the Great Lakes Basin, and the other would be consumptive uses within the basin. This issue started 20-some years ago when there was a proposal for a coal slurry pipeline from Lake Superior to Montana. At that time, we passed there was an agreement between the eight states, which resulted in a charter. That was a good faith agreement between those states to consult and with each other before you would have diversions. The subsequent year, 1986, there was federal law that created gave veto authority to any governor. It required the approval of each of the eight Great Lakes states governors before there was any diversion out of the basin. There's concern that in recent years whether or not that or how defensible that federal standard was, because there weren't any standards with it, there wasn't a process, there wasn't review. So to assure that we had a durable, defensible agreement to protect diversions out of the Great Lakes, we embarked on this effort to develop a compact. A compact is essentially a contract between the states that would be enforceable. And this was done through, there is a Council of Great Lakes Governors group that exists, and that provided the oversight and the coordination for this effort. A year ago, the governor did sign a commitment that we would seek to have this agreement adopted. There's been a lot of public process, a lot of public review. We've had a stakeholder group of industry, environmental interests, tribal interests that have participated over the last 6 years in this process. Minnesota, as you can note on the map on the front page, has a relatively small area of the state. It's about 7% of our land area that's within the Great Lakes Basin. The issues that we have there are mining, of course, along the Laurentian Divide, and then other uses, consumptive uses within the basin. As Representative Huntley said there is a grandfather clause in this agreement that as of the effective date of the agreement, which is when all 8 states adopt it and Congress gives its assent, on that effective date, existing uses are grandfathered in. One of the stumbling blocks in this was what kind of voting that we had to approve diversions out, and there was a lot of there were some states that wished to retain a unanimous vote or having veto authority. There were other states that objected to that. Getting around that process, what the agreement calls for is a prohibition on diversions with some exceptions. And if you look at the map on the very last page in this handout, this map, it shows the Lake Superior watershed, and it shows the communities there in pink. And we have communities that are on both sides of the watershed divide. So their corporate boundaries are on both sides. That's not unique to Minnesota. Akron, Ohio is half in, half out, where we've actually approved a diversion under the existing federal law in Akron. So there is an exception to provide water for the straddling communities, and there's also an exception for straddling counties to deal with adjacent communities. So there is a way to look beyond that, but this would prevent any significant diversion outside of the basin. The Minnesota program is significantly more restrictive than what's proposed in this compact. We have a permit requirement that for appropriation of water that starts at 10,000 gallons a day. In this agreement, there's a registration requirement and notification of water use at a threshold of 100,000 gallons a day. So we've already been doing this. We've had regulations since 1937 on water use. We've got the standards. We don't have any existing Minnesota law that needs to be changed to become compliant with this agreement. As Representative Huntley said, there are diversions in and out of the basin that exist. Those are grandfathered in. The diversion in Chicago is actually operates under a Supreme Court decree. A number of years ago, we had binding mediation between the 8 states and the federal government to resolve some of the issues around that, and that would continue if there were future issues, but the Chicago diversion is outside of this agreement. The consumptive use issue, that's where you're using water and incorporating it into a product, or it's lost to evaporation, it's not returned to the system. That threshold in this agreement is 5 million gallons a day. So that is the equivalent to the amount of water for a city like St. Cloud, 60,000 people consumptive use. It's the mining industries up there aren't most of the time that it's not a consumptive use. They're transferring water. There is some consumptive use in the mining industry. The new proposal for Minnesota steel industries would have a consumptive use of 7 million gallons a day when it's fully built out. What would happen in that process now is if this compact would be in effect, it would go out for review by the other states. They comment back. That decision still rests with Minnesota. So it's still a state decision. It's not, we aren't bound by any other states voting and making that decision for us. Minnesota would be making that state or that decision. This does provide a defensible mechanism for the administration throughout each of the 8 states. I could walk through the bill real quickly if you'd like, Mr. Chairman.
I think we have a question. Sure. Representative Emmer.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And is it Mr. Lockesmall?
Yes, it is.
Just for that, I've got other questions, but for that last statement you just said, and maybe I've taken it out of context, that Minnesota would, in effect, I'm going to paraphrase, my understanding of what you just said is Minnesota would be able to self-determine, still be able to govern itself. Is that what you just said in terms of its ability? Once, if we're part of this compact, we basically give up any authority we have as a state. I mean, I know we already have all of our own laws in place, but we're going to give it up to this council, and we're going to be governed by this council. Isn't that correct?
Mr. Locke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. The compact is going to deal with diversions out, and the compact is an agreement to prohibit diversions. The change from existing law, right now under existing law on a diversion out of the basin, you would need to have the approval of all eight governors. Under this compact, what the compact says, it's in Section 4, or in, Section 4 of the compact, Article 4, that diversions are prohibited. Essentially, they're prohibited today, but they're prohibited today at any amount and for everything. They're also prohibited for a straddling community like Hibbing or Akron, Ohio. So this does take those decisions for it. We don't have any proposed diversions in Minnesota, and I don't anticipate any proposed diversions. The other aspect of this was over consumptive use, where the consumptive use issues are still left with the state of Minnesota. Those final decisions through the permitting process, environmental review, that doesn't change. So what this compact really does from Minnesota's perspective, it brings the water management system of the Great Lakes much closer to the standard that we have in Minnesota.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Loftusmo, here's the difficulty I'm having, is that you've talked about diversion, water diversion, you've talked about consumptive use, but when I read this, it's a lot broader than just water diversion and consumptive use. The language is not so case-specific. It's about water management within the basin, and in our case, it'll be the Lake Superior Basin. Isn't the effect of this compact to turn it over to this new council that we're going to create, much like we have in the state with watershed districts, watershed districts, the same type of principle. Isn't that what we're doing here?
Mr. Lockton, Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer. There's some general oversight for other water management kinds of things. I mean, there is a discussion about water conservation in this document. The water conservation standard that they have is, and that's being developed collectively, is much more general than what we even have today in Minnesota.
Mr. Chairman, as long as we're on that's the part that we seem to be leaving out. If you turn to, and I'm looking for it now, your water management, that's the section that talks about, I think it's in Section 4, or in Article 4, that talks about setting up these standards and these the 5 years that you've got to put together. Standards, is that what you're referring to?
Mr. Chairman, yes.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Lockheed, you reference that as general, but it effectively turns over the authority to this council to set up those plans and then to make sure they're being enforced and followed. Isn't that true?
Mr. Lockheed.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Emmer, the council is setting some overall guiding principles for the states as it relates to water conservation. And the council that's set up under this is essentially the eight governors and the two premiers or their representatives.
I'll be done for now, sure. Mr. Chairman, but I would ask everybody to take a look carefully at Article 4. When Mr. Loftusmo is telling us that this is a very general, it's basically set of guidelines, when I read if line 16.4 under section 4.6, beginning no later than 5 years of the effective date of this compact, the originating party shall provide all parties in the provinces with detailed and timely notice. This is not, I, with all due respect to the author and the testifier, I don't think this is as general as you'd like to have us understand. Maybe it's what your intent is, but it appears this is a lot more detailed, and there are some significant questions about how it might affect the Commerce Clause. There's also questions about the ability of this council to purchase assets and sell assets. And then there's really no provision for us to get out of the compact once we're in it, because it provides at the end that we have to have a majority vote of all members to get out if it's not working for the state of Minnesota. So it effectively gives up our ability to govern our own borders. And I'll just note, your materials, Mr. Lacusmo, are helpful, but I would really like to know, rather than having a kind of an outline of the state of Minnesota in these colors, how far into Minnesota, when you've got the basin here, what specific communities are being impacted that really could fall under the governance of this council, that they won't have any say on who gets elected or who's determining how they self-determine within their own communities how they're going to handle their water supply. But anyway, I'll listen to more, and maybe I've totally missed the point.
Mr. Luxman, you want to respond?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, thank you. There is a map on the final page of the handout that I believe might show what you just asked, Representative Emmer.
It doesn't have the names of the
community. Representative Emmer?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. It doesn't have the names of the
community.
In very fine print.
It's got some of them. Thank you very much.
All right, Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Mr. Locksmall, you just explained the map on the back page. Is it that heavy red line, would that be the boundary of the basin?
Mr. Chairman, Representative House, yes, the heavy red line is the boundary between the watershed basins. And you can see just to the north of Mountain Iron and Hibbing, there's a green arrow and it points Rainy River. That's the Rainy River Hudson Bay drainage. On the left side of this map is the Mississippi River drainage basin. And then you have adjacent Lake Superior, the Lake Superior Basin. So this shows three of the major drainage basins of Minnesota.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Locksmo, I think this has been going, you don't have to answer this question, but I think it's been going on for quite some time. I recall seeing this 6 to 8 years ago, something very similar to this. And the concern back then, which has sort of been touched on by Representative Emmer, but my concern is, let's say I purchased some land in St. Louis County and it's within this basin and I'm going to drill a well. What if this compact, or does this compact, could this compact affect whether or not I can drill a well and draw water?
Mr. Lacusmo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative House, no. And the reason I would say no is you would have to be the section that Representative Emmer referenced on section 4.6. These are the projects subject to prior notice. And prior notice is only required for a consumptive use of water, drilling a well and using it, if you use over 5 million gallons a day. 5 million gallons a day is the water supply for 60,000 people. 5 million gallons a day is, the water supply for the MSI new steel plant. That's a lot of water. So on the individual projects that don't meet those thresholds, nothing changes in Minnesota. And the only thing that changes for a consumptive use that's larger than 5 million gallons a day is the fact that we would send those projects out to the adjacent states for their comment. And all they do is comment, and the state still makes a decision. We have that existing requirement right now under the charter that's in existing Minnesota law, where we look at consumptive uses of more than 2 million gallons a day. So there are, we adopted all of the charter requirements, and that's a good faith agreement. We do still have prior notice and consultation with the adjacent states. But this does not affect any small users of water in the future.
Representative Hobbs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Locksmo, I understand what you're saying, but if the home I built was near Hibbing, and Hibbing was pulling out X amount of gallons per day out of their well, and my well would
put us over that threshold. I want to know where in here it says that my well will not be shut down. Mr. Lachtsma.
Mr. Chairman and Representative House, this compact becomes effective when all eight states and Congress approves. The consumptive use, and as of that date, all existing uses are grandfathered in. Consumptive use provisions in this compact are effective 10 years after that effective date. And it is only dealing with new and increased consumptive uses. So if the city of Hibbing was appropriating 4.99 million gallons a day and your new use would put them over, it has to be a new use of 5 million gallons a day, not that extra 10 gallons that puts them over 5 million gallons a day.
Representative House. Mr. Chairman, just to follow up to that comment, the compact, the members of this, can they, once this becomes law, can they make changes to that without coming back to the Minnesota legislature?
Mr. Lachtsma.
The group could propose changes to do that, but this is going to be Minnesota law, and we would have to come back here to have legislative consent.
So, Mr. Chairman, then we're being taped, and I will trust that what I heard was that if the group of this compact were to make changes in the future, it would have to come to the legislature in order for us to approve and enact those changes. And all the groups and states and territories would have to approve that to make those changes.
Mr. Lockhart. Chairman, Representative of the House, yes, that's my understanding.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wolfschlager.
Chair, members, Mr. Lachtsma, when I look at this in a nutshell, aren't you trying more to stop, you know, a pipeline, for example, to the southwest? You know, some big divergence of water or, you know, some shift in power in the United States where, you know, a more powerful portion of the United States wants water, you know, and comes up to our states and says, I want it.
Mr. Lachtsma.
Mr. Chairman, Representative. Yes, that's certainly one of the goals of this is to protect the existing resources and keep them within the basin and have the waters of the Great Lakes being managed by the states of the Great Lakes and not having been taken over by Congress.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lachtsma, I appreciate the clarity of your responses, but I'm concerned with Representative Amers and Representative House's concerns as well, and want to ask if you could highlight provisions in the bill to confirm your understanding of the bill. You provide very clear sense and confidence of the position of your position as to what you believe the bill means, but as I look, I'm actually looking in Article 3 on page 9. Forgive me for what I might be missing, but on line 14, 15, and 16, the council shall identify priorities and develop plans and policies related to basin water resources. It shall adopt and promote uniform and coordinated policies for water resources, conservation, and management in the basin. Now, that's language that, in the context of the language, I don't see it refer to any other provision, and it's very broad and just general, as it's listed there, general powers and duties. And to Representative House's question, that would seem to apply.
Mr. Lachtsma.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson. I think if you look at lines 3 and 4, which lead off that section, the waters are subject to the sovereign right and responsibility of the parties. And each of the party has their own responsibility. Most of the states have to adopt new regulatory schemes to be able to comply with this compact. And there is discussion There was a discussion about what types of water conservation we should have as part of this this compact. And some states weren't real interested in having any conservation that was discussed and talked about regionally. But if we're going to have a compact that deals with eliminating diversions out and protecting these waters inside the basin, we really need to responsibly manage the waters that we have. So, I mean, we were a strong proponent for having a strong conservation ethic as part of this compact. Minnesota already has that. We require conservation emergency plans for communities. We've eliminated the wasteful uses of water in this state. And those are things that we've done statewide, not just limited to this basin. So I think I can, might take me a minute to find the answers to the rest of your question, but I think Minnesota, we aren't looking at needing to make any other structural changes in our body of law.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So now we're going in a number of directions here, but it's great that other states are going to have to adopt new regulations and come up to par with our, what I understand to be better regulations, but I still don't see how this does not provide general authority and broad authority for conservation and management. You look on line 11, upon unanimous vote of all council members by regulation adopted in the section below, under the section below, each party's, on line 13, each party's respective statutory authorities and applicable procedures will apply, as I understand it. That line 14, 15, and 16 seems to be very general and broad authority, and with unanimous vote, if I'm understanding this correctly, begging your pardon if I'm not, I think this goes well beyond what I'm understanding you to say.
Mr. Lacasmo.
The standard of review and decision is right now under existing federal law for review of diversion, there is no standard. So what we did as part of the development of this is provide that standard. And it was a long negotiated process. So if there's to be a change in the existing standard, that requires a unanimous vote of the council members.
Mr. Chair?
Symbols.
I guess maybe another way to ask my question is I don't see a reference here in this context to diversion, and maybe it's in the definitions. Maybe that's where I'm missing it.
Mr. Locke as well.
Diversion is in the definitions on page 2, line 34. And it's a transfer of water from the Great Lakes watershed to outside of the watershed. And it also references transfers within the Great Lakes watershed, like from Lake Michigan to Lake Huron watersheds, which for Minnesota purposes, it would only be from Lake Superior out of Lake Superior watershed.
Mr. Chair,
symbols.
Begging your pardon, I'll end with this, but I'm not happy yet with my understanding of the bill. Lines 14 and 15 and 16, my point with regard to diversion is there's nothing in the definitions that could lead me to believe, from what I've seen so far, that conservation and management only applies to diversion. It could not be used to apply to the concern of Representative House.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, yes, conservation would be applied to more than diversions. We would talk about a very general conservation plan for the entire basin. And as we've looked at, and as the discussions have been moving forward with the conservation planning, they still are well below the existing conservation efforts that we have in Minnesota. So the conservation plan is it's more of an umbrella conservation plan than getting at specifics that you shall. It's to eliminate unaccounted for water in municipal systems. We already have that standard when we review the emergency and conservation plan. It's to allow or to not allow wasteful uses of water. We already have that in our statutory scheme of water regulation.
So, Mr. Chair, Mr. Lacasmal, so is the primary purpose of this bill, as far as the state of Minnesota, to influence all the other states to improve their standards of management?
Mr. Locke.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bolton, I wouldn't say that was the primary purpose, but I think that's, you know, that will be one of the results. The other states have virtually no regulatory programs that are dealing with water appropriations. They may have a registration requirement, which is just a notification that you've got a big system and you're using more than 100,000 gallons a day. But Minnesota has had a water appropriation permit program since 1937. We regulate uses more than 10,000 gallons a day, or a million a year. And you know, on the Canadian side, Ontario has something similar. But the other nine entities or eight entities in this agreement and compact have a wide range of regulatory authority. So this would bring them all up to a little bit higher level of regulation, although it doesn't, I don't see any of them getting anywhere close to what Minnesota has, because we're still talking about consumptive uses of, you know, over 100,000 gallons a day, and this only comes into play if you have a use of more than 5 million gallons a day.
Representative Olson. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate your comments. Mr. Lacasmal, so what I understand here then is that that is a plus, as is being presented, that other states will have to come up to par, and that does affect us. So I see your points there. But as we do that, we're establishing an entity that has the authority to go beyond where we are, and later, at a later date, it could also come back and have the effects that Representative House was concerned about. At some point in time.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bolton, theoretically that, I believe, is true. However, it was a struggle with most of those other entities to get them to agree at this level. So the odds of coming up with something that would be more stringent on consumptive uses within the states is extremely remote. And even then, the like I said, this consumptive use provisions of this compact start, you know, it's probably 15 years from now. It's 10 years after the effective date of the compact. Because there were states that that didn't want any consumptive use provisions in here. In the early discussions on consumptive use, we talked about having lower thresholds and having some approval authority, whether it's a majority of the eight states agreeing on a large consumptive uses. Those were rejected. And Governor Pawlenty wasn't in favor of those as one of the governors. And because we don't want other states having competition between whatever industry to go, you know, to another state because they can get approval, or they veto our project because they want to lure that business to their state. So those were recognized, and there's protections in here, so that kind of thing can't happen.
Representative Olson.
One comment. No more questions.
All right.
Thank you. Mr. Lacasmal, I see some benefit, but having the concerns in the years out doesn't alleviate my concerns, given the history of the Clean Water Legacy Act and how I can imagine what it was like when that was passed in the first place, and how this is how many years out we are putting something in place that will be well established when those concerns come down the pike. And at that point, I think we'll have something that is possibly even more difficult to deal with in conjunction with the Clean Water Legacy Act. So I think there's some other issues here, and I hope this has many more committees to go to, or that it might be stalled here and we can look at it further. Thank you.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Lacusmal, I guess getting to the question that Representative Olson's asking, you're saying in this general policy or 9 that it has to be unanimous vote of all the governors to make it to be more restrictive?
Mr. Lacusmal.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes.
And does
Representative Nelson.
Mr. Lacusmal, does Minnesota then, I'm reading this, the governor is our representative here, so if it's something that would be contrary to Minnesota interests, I would assume he would vote, whoever the governor is at that time, he or she would vote against that issue, something that would be more restrictive of Minnesota?
Mr. Lacusmal.
Mr. Chairman, yes, it's the governor or his designee.
His
designee. But you're right, they would, I'm sure, reflect the desires of the state.
So then there wouldn't be unanimous votes, so that provision wouldn't go forward. So I think there's that protection there for each individual state and for the state of Minnesota.
Mr. Lacusmal.
Mr. Chairman and Representative, yes, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And members, we have 3 more individuals that wish to come up and testify on the bill. So let's move to those 3. I don't know if they want to come up all together one at a time, but I've got Allison Wolf as the first one. Welcome to the committee, and as you make your comments, would you please identify yourself for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Allison Wolf. I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, which comprises 80-some environmental groups in our state, whom are represented by my colleagues here, also on behalf of the Minnesota Center for Environmental Advocacy. We urge you to move this legislation forward. It was very popular when we brought it before the Minnesota Environmental Partnership, and I think there's a kinship with Lake Superior among all Minnesotans. People really feel that it's their lake, even though we only have 270 miles of shoreline. It's also the largest, deepest, and coldest lake in the Great Lakes system. It's so deep it could swallow up all the other Great Lakes, plus 2 more Lake Eries. This vastness can make the lake seem invulnerable, but that's not the case. We've heard a little bit today from Representative Huntley about the low water levels, but it really highlights the dramatic effect of the low water levels when you realize that for each inch below normal water levels, a freighter has to remove 270 tons from a load in order to get into some of the more shallow areas of our very deep lake. So economic and environmental effects go hand in hand when you're talking about Great Lakes issues. The water of the Great Lakes is at risk of being sold to the highest bidder. It's always sounded kind of like science fiction, but the Duluth Tribune just last August reported on a proposal that's very much under discussion in southwestern states. This was referred to a little bit earlier, but this is a live proposal that would put water pipelines along I-35, along the I-35 corridor from Duluth down to Texas. And water was specifically mentioned as one of the substances that could be flowing through those pipelines. So it doesn't appear to be science fiction, and I think the urgency to take this action to protect our lakes is really one that we need to think about. I think I'll be brief, but I would like to just say that one of the features we like about the compact is that it does allow Minnesota to be more protective, and we've talked about our current laws doing that, and we certainly endorse that continued ability of Minnesota to make its own decisions about this area. So with that, thank you, and I'll conclude my testimony with that.
All right. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Dave Dempsey. I'm representing the Clean Water Action Alliance this morning from Minnesota. We are here in support of this compact legislation. It's been said that that water will be the oil of the 21st century, and that's because in a growing world of over 6 billion people, there are many areas of not just the world, but also of the United States that are suffering water scarcity. Lake Superior alone has 10% of the world's available surface fresh water. So the purpose of the compact, if ratified, is to assure that the 8 Great Lakes states maintain control and decision-making power over the 10% of the world's available fresh water. The concern that arose in 1998 when this agreement really was initiated came when a company called the Nova Group obtained a permit from the province of Ontario to ship 50 tankers per year of Lake Superior water to Asia. This compact, if ratified, would ban any such proposal. At the same time, it would also bring other states up to the level of Minnesota in terms of water conservation and regulation, as we've discussed. So essentially, this compact is an insurance policy for Minnesota and the other Great Lakes states to assure that we retain control of decision-making over the Great Lakes, and that's why we're urging you to support ratification. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. So, Mr. Chairman, finally, Gary Botsik. I'm representing Minnesota Conservation Federation. I can also represent Minnesota Audubon as well in support of this legislation, all part of MEP. My angle on this, Mr. Chairman, is the Minnesota Conservation Federation is a state alliance with the National Wildlife Federation, and they, out of their Ann Arbor, Michigan office, have been working on this project from its inception, and many of the questions that were raised today were addressed many times over, as Mr. Lacassimo can attest. And this is the baseline. This is not the ceiling. This is a baseline. We could be proud of the protection that we've put in place in Minnesota. Do we want to guard that? Do we want to protect that? Yes. And I think you, as legislators and the governor, whoever he or she might be, is going to be ultimately responsible for that. But we support this provision as well. One of the couple of interesting facts, Representative Olson mentioned the Clean Water Legacy. The governor just put $40 million in his budget for a Clean Water Legacy. Yes, so it's a very expensive proposition to clean up waters that have been impaired over the last 100 years or whatever. But also bear in mind, Representative Olson, that rivers aren't burning in Ohio or Illinois anymore. We have done a great deal of work on cleaning up our waters. The point problem, we have more point work to do, but we need to move into non-point. And so when we need to protect bodies of water as big as Lake Superior, this is a tremendous opportunity. This is a tremendous resource. This is a treasure in our not even our backyard, but our front yard. You know how important it is to commerce. Representative Huntley mentioned that. But think about the fisheries. Think about the sandbars that are extending out in Lake Superior now that are going to inhibit some of our salmon to get up the streams to spawn. There's about some 80-year low right now on water levels on Lake Superior. And that thing doesn't refill by water and snow. We have some problems, but this compact is a major step in the right direction. We urge support. Rep. Semmels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Botsik, I really appreciate the acknowledgement that we have made progress, because all too often in these debates we hear that we haven't and we aren't making sufficient progress. The Clean Water Legacy Act, the $40 million, is a drop in the bucket, as you know, because the federal figures reflect in the 60 or better billion-dollar range, and we aren't even close. You know that I worked for 8 years in this place to get approval for a project that is now being implemented. You may or may not know the success of that project on Indian Lake. The point of bringing it up is this. That project in 3 months has taken a lake that had no whitecaps on it and was green to the point of having whitecaps and 10 feet of clarity on a sunny day when there wasn't but a foot or two. Now, we're going to put thousands and thousands of dollars into evaluating that lake, and all they did is put a few thousand dollars into treating it. And in 3 months had astounding results. My point is that there are better ways to do things, and this language raises a lot of concerns and a lot of questions. And when I dealt with the Clean Water Legacy Act on the House floor in preparation for that, each person I called to get information from the group, I think it was the G16 group, each person I called admitted to me they had not read the Federal Clean Water Act. I think the implications of this are so serious, we ought not be moving forward so quickly. It is well intended. I appreciate those intentions. I value those intentions. And I look at language on line 21 on page 9, where it talks about the council powers and references any interest. We go down to line 25. Where service properties and services may be transferred or made available to it by any party. And then later on in line 27, pursuant to law. If you read all of that in its context, it raises a lot of questions about what can happen later that's totally out of our control. The federal law, How about international law? You start creating entities like this, and it's really out of our control. Even though we have unanimous vote of a council, because that can change as well by those laws that are out of our control. And we don't have time for all the questions this raises, which means I don't believe we should move forward with this.
Are there any response from the three of you?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Olson, I would only say that the analogy that comes to my mind is a UN and a Security Council veto. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people say that doesn't work, and a lot of people think that's our last hope. And I think some of our states' rights, as we, much as we need to protect them, we have to look at our neighbors, especially when we live and survive off of the same water bodies. We need to at least work together, talk together, communicate together. I don't think this language, I think when they talk about holding property, I think they're talking about buildings, you know, where staff are going to be, things like that. You know, Lock of Smoke can clarify that further for you, but I don't think this is a land grab or a water basin grab. I think this is a bureaucratic measure to better protect our Great Lakes, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'm hearing good, clear statements of intent. But if you look at the language on line 20, it says institute court actions in the context of the language I just referenced. And I'm just holding back because I think I could go further, much further. This is a lot more than what we think it is.
Do we have anyone else who wishes to testify for or against this bill today? Are there any further questions of the representative? Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Anybody who's testified, and maybe you already said it and I missed it while I was reading, but is it true that no entity has actually passed this compact yet? Is that correct?
It might be better at this point if we brought back, I think, the author and Mr. Lacasmo. I think that's a question that should come from either the author or Mr. Lacasmo.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Emmer, that is correct. Minnesota would be the first state to pass this.
Representative Emmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Huntley, why do you believe we need to be the first? In light of the questions that have been raised this morning, I mean, everybody agrees on the goal, protect the waters, but it seems that this is incredibly far-reaching, much farther than Mr. Lacasmo, I believe, would even want.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Emmer, any significant changes of this would have to be approved, again, by all eight governors and the two provinces, so any significant change would require that unanimous vote. Again, it's been approved by eight governors. Actually, it's been approved probably by 16 governors, because since it started, there's been a turnover in nearly every state. Actually, it was signed by Ventura when it started here. It's now approved by Governor Pawlenty. The governors of all these states support this, are very interested in it. They think that passing this will protect the Great Lakes from any significant diversion of water out of the basin to someplace else.
Representative Huntley, the governor signed the compact. I also assume he would sign this bill. Correct? So he's in full support of the
bill. Mr. Chairman, and members, the governor is very supportive of this issue, and I can assure you he will sign the bill.
Representative House.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Huntley, I appreciate what you're doing here, and I understand your passion for it, and I think your ideas are good. Mr. Lacasmo, the parts that scare me are the Section 3.3, that's page 9, line 30. The council may promulgate and enforce such rules and regulations as may be necessary for the implementation and enforcement of this compact. That makes me nervous. You know full well that the DNR sometimes, in their good judgment to protect the state of Minnesota, makes some rules. And within 3 to 4 weeks of those rulemaking processes and you come out with your decision, most of the time, you've done a great job. Every once in a great while, the public goes crazy. You guys dig in, and your rule is now before the legislature. I don't see that happening with this. I see it eight governors. But what if we rewind the tape a little bit and we have Governor Jesse Ventura? Can I see a show of hands of those that would support the decisions he makes with regard to this?
Oh.
All right, it's not overwhelming, but this bill makes me very nervous. Mr. Chairman, I know a motion isn't being made, not the proper time probably, but when the motion is made to move this bill, I don't really think it should be a consent calendar bill. You're getting that sense, Mr. Chairman?
Representative Howes, the motion that I did make was to send it to be placed on the general registry. I did not say consent because of your objection to it, and that's fine. And there has been a very good discussion, so should the motion prevail, it would go to the general registry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
No. Representative Olson, one more time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Or should I say one last time?
Well, there'll be more on the floor if it gets there. Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Lacus-Mohan, and I just want to encourage members to take a look at Section 3.2 one more time. And I didn't really go into it because I know I get the sense that we don't really have the time. But there's a few other places. You got all this, the word any. This is the council powers. And there's issues right above it with the council powers and duties. Again, I hear that the unanimous vote of the council is a protective factor. But this language, talking about any interest on line 21, any party, pursuant to law, could be federal law. There's no clarity that I see as to whether or not it has to be our state law or our governor involved. And then after that, pursuant to law and have and exercise all powers necessary or convenient to carry out its express powers or which may be reasonably implied. I mean, I don't know how to get broader than this. I don't know how to do it. This is so incredibly broad and vague as to any limits. And I don't believe we really know what this means. Because when you get broad and vague...
I would suggest, should the motion prevail, that you meet with Mr. Lacusmo prior to the floor and have him address some of your concerns. So that you would be prepared for the floor.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to meet with more than Mr. Lacusmo.
Representative Olson, I can fully anticipate that.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess if it's going to go to the general register, I do have maybe one or two more questions because the author and specifically the witnesses have testified that this won't change anything in law, and states will be responsible to update their own laws, but that doesn't seem to make sense. I mean, if that's true, then there would be no need for the repealer language that you find right at the end. There is a specific provision in here on page 29, Section 9.1, that says all acts and parts of acts inconsistent with this act are to the extent of such inconsistency hereby repealed. And I haven't heard, all I've heard is anecdotal statements or statements by folks here saying, you know, our rules are already the best out there. It doesn't, there's no need for the repealer. If, in fact, we are going to be in control, this legislature, as Representative Howes was advised, is going to be responsible to address these rules. That's not what this act says. And not to keep kicking the old dead horse, but Representative Olson has correctly pointed out a problem with the bill. And if you look at page 9, I'm just going to emphasize one more time, from lines 9.25 to 9.28, we've already talked about, the witness, Mr. Lacusmo, has talked about the notice provision for significant diversion or consumption. Notice is not what we're worried about. We're worried about the far-reaching authority of this board, and it goes well beyond just those big uses. It talks about cumulative impacts and individual uses. And if you look at these lines, Mr. Chairman, it says, exercise such other and different powers as may be delegated to it by this compact or otherwise pursuant to law, and have and exercise all powers necessary or convenient to carry out its express powers, or which may be reasonably implied therefrom. I mean, this is, I guess I'd like to know, that's more of a statement and I apologize, but if we've got the repealer language, has anybody, the author or anybody that has been advising him, gone through line and verse and figured out what acts or parts of acts are going to be repealed by enacting this?
Mr. Lockesmo.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Amherst, we had in law the charter provisions that were put in law in about 1986. The charter was signed in 1985. Those provide for prior notice and consultation of diversions over 2 million gallons a day, or of over 5 million gallons a day. And this would supersede that. That's the only, it's something that could remain in law. But it could also be deleted because this would supersede that. That's the only section that I'm aware of.
Representative Emmer.
No, I've said enough for today. Other than no.
Representative Kalin.
I just wanted to, thank you, Mr. Chair, I just want to make quickly address the concerns being raised and explain as how I balance between being a libertarian and a conservationist, and I've actually signed on to this bill. And that is, I just would like to direct members to Section 3.3, the second paragraph, so the top of page 10. 3.3.1, which we've talked about, reads, the council may promulgate and enforce such rules and regulations as may be necessary for the implementation and enforcement. And but section 2, paragraph 2, reads, each party, in accordance with respect to statutory authorities, may adopt and enforce rules and regulations to implement and enforce this compact. If that language had been or shall adopt, I would be much more reticent to support adoption. But I think that the sort of slippery slope argument is valid, and there are important concerns, obviously, when we deal with conservation, but I do believe that here we have a pretty good retaining law on the slippery slope, and that I'm comfortable supporting it after having considered this and spoken with other folks who signed on to the compact.
All right. Members, I'm going to renew my motion that House File 110 be recommended to be passed and be placed on the General Registry. All those in
Madam
favor?
Madam Chair, or
Representative Olson.
I'm sorry. I want to ask for a roll call vote, please.
Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes aye.
Representative Anderson?
Aye.
Representative Broad?
Aye.
Representative Emmer?
No.
Representative Hilty?
Aye.
Representative Howes?
No.
Representative Kahn is excused. Representative Kalin?
Aye.
Representative Morgan?
Aye.
Representative Nelson?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
No.
Representative Peterson?
No.
Representative Poppy?
Aye.
Representative Poppy?
Aye.
Representative Simon?
Aye.
Representative Winkler?
Aye.
Representative Wolschlager?
Aye.
Seeing 11 ayes and 4 nays, the motion prevails. Representative Huntley, you're still with us. We have House File 163. Members, I'm going to move that House File 163 be recommended to pass and be referred to Local and Government Affairs. I'm sorry, Local and Metro Affairs. Representative Huntley, I believe there are some amendments. I think I'm going to have Mr. Shepard. Is there just one amendment that we need to put this in order, Mr. Shepard?
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Huntley has a delete everything amendment that I think is in the members' packet. It's labeled H0163DE1, and then he had a technical correction to that, which is being distributed now.
All right, so the delete everything, H163DE1. Members, I will move the delete everything amendment. So all those in favor of the delete everything amendment, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, nay. Motion prevails. The bill is amended, and then there is a... All right, you're now getting HRD. And Mr. Shepard, can you explain... And we'll wait for the members to get it, what this does to the bill as amended.
Mr. Chair and members, the amendment that is being passed around now is amending the delete everything amendment. It makes the first section of the bill effective immediately, as the second section is. It also changes the proposed coding of the second section, so it would be coded in the laws governing the State Board of Investment, and then it makes two technical changes in the title of the bill.
Members, I'm going to move this amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion prevails, and the delete everything is amendment. The bill should be in the form now, Representative Huntley, that you request.
Mr. Chair, I think we need another amendment on page 2. On line 2.2, where it says executive director, that should be City of Duluth. And that's para has requested that change.
Mr. Representative Huntley, Mr. Shepard, could you clarify that amendment, please?
Yeah, yes, Mr. Chair and members, on the DE1 amendment that you adopted, on page 2, line 2 of that amendment, it would delete the words executive director and insert the words City of Duluth.
Mr. Shepard, can I incorporate that into my previous amendment, or should we do a separate one?
Mr. Chair, because you already voted on the prior one, it probably would be best to vote on that.
Then I will move, I'll move that correction also, members. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Representative Huntley, do we have the bill as you wish to have it?
Yes. And, Mr. Chair and members, this represents a serious problem for the City of Duluth. Back in,
1983,
when I was on the City Council, actually, the City had a problem with its employees in terms of sick leave that they were not accounting for on the books, and when employees retired, they had huge amounts of sick leave, and the state auditor at that time, Arnie Carlson, told the city that they needed to be a little bit more accurate in how they accounted for these things, and the upshot of that is that the city, in exchange for the unions giving up a lot of sick leave, gave them free health care when they retired. And at that time, one city councilor who voted for that, and happens to be sitting here today, suggested that they ought to put that on the books every year. Unfortunately, for the last 20 years, the cost of that benefit has not been accounted for. And if you ever want Enron accounting, this is it. The result is there is a potential liability for the city of about $300 million. And if you want to put that in perspective, the city budget is, what, 70?
$78 million.
So it is a huge problem for the City of Duluth. They are now finally starting to address that problem. And one of the things they want to do is set up an irrevocable trust fund where they can put money in and can't get it out except for this particular reason. This is just the first step. They need clarification, and I think in your packet you have something that came out yesterday, I believe, from the legislative auditor. And if you look on page 3, it's highlighted there, and just the beginning is, Minnesota local jurisdictions lack clear authority to establish irrevocable trusts for funding other post-employment benefits.
Representative Huntley, we had almost 2 hours yesterday on that report. We're fully informed.
And so
your bill could become more than you know.
This would allow then the city to set up this irrevocable trust fund, have it managed by the state. The state does a significantly better job of than the city can do in terms of interest rates, and it would save the city a lot of money. And I have here the from the city of Duluth, Jenny Stark, to go into the details.
All right, welcome, and please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, my name is Jeannie Stark. I'm the finance director for the city of Duluth. House File 163 is the city's number one priority for the 2007 legislative session. This legislation would authorize the city to establish certain investment accounts which would allow us to meet longstanding obligations to pay for retiree health benefits. Our current projected obligation for this benefit now exceeds $300 million. Our proposal asks for authority so that we can set aside our own resources in accounts which will achieve a greater return on investment than we can possibly achieve under existing city authority. In other words, we are not looking for state funding. We will solve this problem on our own if you give us the tools to do so. The current administration of Mayor Bergson is tackling this issue head on. As Representative Huntley said, in 1983, the city first offered retiree health benefits. And since that time, we've been funding and paying for them, the retiree claims, on a pay-as-you-go basis. As Representative Huntley said, no money was set aside for future costs, and actually current accounting standards would not allow us to, we could fund it, but we couldn't actually book the liability as we have to now. But in 2004, the Governmental Accounting Standards Board released their statement number 45, which requires governmental units beginning in 2007 to recognize and account for the estimated future cost of the liability. The statement does not require the liability to be funded, only to be recognized and reported on financial statements. However, fiscal prudence, not to mention bond rating agencies and financial institutions, will require a plan of action and a significant level of funding. And in our bond rating calls, we've already been discussing our plan of action with both Moody's and Standard & Poor's, so they're well aware of what we're intending to do. The only way that GASB number 45 allows the liability to be reduced is to pay the current cost or to deposit monies in an irrevocable trust fund. There is currently no state authorization allowing governmental units to set up such a fund for this purpose. In 2005, a special task force was established to examine the City of Duluth's liability. The task force made a series of recommendations, including seeking enactment of the statutory authority to allow the city to invest its resources more aggressively. As Representative Huntley has indicated, the language before you now is slightly different from the version that was first introduced, and actually it's changed since I walked in this room. The author's amendment is the product of discussions which have taken place between city officials and representatives from the State Board of Investment, the Office of the State Auditor, and the Public Employee Retirement Association. The primary objective here is to establish two accounts. The first would be an irrevocable trust, which would receive a significant initial deposit and then subsequent annual deposits of city resources in order to meet the city's estimated future obligations to pay for retiree health benefits. The City Council has already taken action approving rate increases for all of our utilities, which will put in an estimated $2.4 million a year towards this liability. And we will be, the mayor has proposed funding an initial deposit from our Community Investment Trust Fund of $10 million into this account. The second account we are asking for would receive the remainder of the city's community investment fund, which is where the $10 million deposit came from. After the initial deposit is made into the irrevocable trust, the community investment fund is the source of payment for city bonds that we issue have issued to finance street improvements. And so we need to achieve a higher rate of return on this fund in order to fulfill our obligations after taking out that $10 million. We have distributed materials from the city outlining the issue and our overall strategy to address this significant liability. And I think there's a copy of this pamphlet for your reading. The sooner we can begin putting our resources aside, the sooner we will be on a path to solve this problem on our own. We understand that there are other jurisdictions that have concerns regarding these unfunded liabilities. And we know that there will be language that will provide some authority on a broader basis, and we do not oppose such an initiative. However, the two pieces of our plan are interdependent, and we don't want to delay any longer than we have to. We worked with the state auditor and other governmental entities in 2006 to secure authorization to allow all of us to set up irrevocable trust for OPEB, and when that did not succeed, Duluth sought an amendment at the very end of the session, which would have provided some of the authority that we are seeking here today. As Representative Huntley has mentioned, the 2006 amendment did receive bipartisan support, but failed when the vehicle to which an amendment was attached did not proceed for final action on the House floor. It's my understanding that there are representatives from the State Board of Investment here today to indicate their support for this proposal and respond to questions. And at this time, I would ask for your support of this initiative, and I would be happy to answer any questions that you may have for me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think because we're pressed for time, if there's anyone else who wishes to come down and testify, I know Ms. Bile does, so why don't we get testimony from those individuals? Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm Julie Bile, representing AFSCME Council 5, and I will summarize my testimony and submit a written copy of it for your records. We support House File 163, authored by Representative Huntley, because it would permit cities to invest for retiree health expenses. By supporting the State Board of Investments, or we are supportive of the State Board of Investments, administering the trust and doing the investing. We urge you to support the bill, which will provide for long-term financial health of the cities like Duluth, and also provide for retirees, which through their contract have been promised this benefit, to be able to retire with dignity. And I'll submit a written copy of the statement and report, which outlines what previously has been described as a problem in the city of Duluth. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Members, any questions? Seeing none, thank you very much. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill? Any further discussion by the committee? Representative Brooke.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I guess my first question is related to the amendment that we put on with the language. Actually, it was the second amendment. Maybe Mr. Shepherd can help me understand why we would insert the words appropriating money. If I heard the testimony correct, there is no state participation that they're requesting today, so I'm curious about those words.
Mr. Shepherd.
Mr. Chair and Representative Broad, the joint rules of the House and the Senate just require as a matter of form that the title include the words appropriating money, if the bill has any. And on the amendment that you adopted on page 1, line 18, you'll notice that the PERA is authorized to charge the City of Duluth fees for administrative costs, and in order for PERA to get those fees back to it, they are appropriated to PERA. So there's no real state money here. It's just whatever fees the city of Duluth pays to PERA would be paid back to appropriated to PERA to administer this fund.
Representative Broad.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Shepherd, on that. I'm somewhat curious. You know, we did hear from the auditor yesterday about these irrevocable trusts and how there's a need on a more statewide basis to do something like that. And I know that in your comments you mentioned that you'd rather get yours going first. But I'm wondering why there needs to be a state participation in you setting up those trusts if what the state auditor or what the legislative auditor suggested was that we just give cities the authority. Why then would we make that next step? I'm trying to understand that a little bit better.
Are you capable of handling that question, or would you like Mr. Shepherd to handle that question?
I think I could take a stab at it, Mr.
All right. All right.
One of the reasons that we would like to have this authority is that current state statutes limit cities and other local government units to certain investments that are very safe and that have a very low return. Right now, the city is earning, on average, about 5%, and the 10-year average for the State Board of Investment was almost double that, and that makes a significant impact on how much money can be accumulated into the irrevocable trust. And as a consequence of having a higher rate of return, our liability, we did have an actuarial study done in 2005 which came up with the $289 million, which is now $300 million. But we had the same actuary give us a different estimated liability if we used 8.5%, which is even lower than what the State Board of Investment was, and it would cut the liability from $289 million down to $153 million. So it's got a major impact on the liability, and that's why we are looking for the State Board of Investment to do the investment, and that was what the bill was last year also.
Representative Brett, I'd like a clarification at this point because of the testimony we took yesterday from Mr. Shepherd. The issue in this bill is the irrevocable trust and an AG's opinion. So I just briefly at this point like Mr. Shepherd to address the Attorney General's opinion on whether a local unit of government can establish in statute an irrevocable trust without a bill like this, because I think that's one of the issues that we had that was brought forward yesterday by the legislative auditor, and I think it's one of the central issues to this. And Mr. Shepherd, could you explain that in reference to Representative Broad's question and my request?
Yes, Mr. Chair and Representative Broad. First of all, I don't know that there's been a formal Attorney General's opinion, but I think when this issue was brought up last year in some discussions I was part of, and then again this year, it appears that both the Attorney General and last year the State Auditor believe that just as a matter of municipal law that cities don't have authority to set up these trusts on their own, just because there's a general principle of municipal law that cities only have authority that's expressly granted to them. And so both the Attorney General and others felt that it would be preferable to have specific legislation that authorized these, just to clarify that they can be authorized. And I believe in reading over the legislative auditor's report from yesterday that was the conclusion that they came to as well.
And thank you, Mr. Shepherd. And Representative Brown, I think one of the issues that we're faced with looking at the problem that we were presented with yesterday was whether we should do this city by city or whether we should allow all of the cities and or actually all of the local units of government involved here to establish these trusts if they need to do it. That's one of the issues that's going to come before us. In this case, it happens to be Duluth. But I think the broader question is, and that was my reference to Representative Huntley's bill and how it may be something more than he really knows. Should we decide that city by city, or should we decide it as one of these steps in a solution to an entire problem that was presented to us yesterday? I don't mean to cut off your testimony, but that is a central issue to this bill and to our problem with the pensions. Representative Brock.
And Mr. Chairman, thank you very much for that. And I agree that that's the central issue, and it would go a little further than in hearing the answer to the question, is that if we allow Duluth to have the State Board of Investment participate, then why not all the others? And what does that mean for the state? What does that mean for the State Board of Investment going forward? What does that mean, and how does it entangle the state in these different pension issues throughout? And that's those are some of the questions that I have as I'm trying to work through some of this. One thing that might be helpful to me is that I'm somewhat curious what the city of Duluth has done over time since that 1983, if I heard you correctly, Representative Huntley vote to provide free health care to those retirees. And I hope that this gives us a lesson that in the end, nothing is free. I'm somewhat curious, and you don't need to do it today, but I'd be curious of a yearly, you know, this is what the city of Duluth has done to help fix the problem from 1983 to where we sit today. I'm just kind of curious as to the action steps that have been taken thus far, trying to anticipate action steps into the future. Just at some point, if I could get that information, that'd be helpful.
Yeah. Representative Huntley, you would provide Representative Broad and right. this committee with that information.
And Mr. Chair and members, I would say that two mayors did absolutely nothing on this for most of that time. And after Enron, when all the accounting rules changed, they also changed for cities and local units of government, and they are now required to put the cost of these things on their books, which we should have done in 1983 and did not. The other thing is to this bill. Last year, we attempted to get on a general bill for all the cities, and for whatever reason, it failed right at the end and did not get a hearing on the floor. Duluth can't wait. We have to get this done. And besides that, there are two accounts in this one, one for the retirees, and then there's the other account as well.
The other account is our community chair and representatives. The other account is our community investment trust fund, which we have dedicated to street improvement program, and it's been ongoing since 1993. We've been issuing bonds since 1993 and using that as a funding source to pay the debt service on these bonds. It's a 25-year program. The mayor's proposal is to take $10 million out of this account, and how we had hoped to replenish it was by securing a higher rate of return by investing it with the State Board of Investment. And that's why we wanted to secure the language as Duluth only at this point in time, because we have this other account that's tied to it. As I said earlier, we do not oppose, we fully support all other units of government seeking this language. And I do understand that other units may not want to necessarily use the State Board of Investment. They may want to use other outside sources, and we don't oppose that, but we propose using the State Board of Investment.
Representative Pearson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As I was looking this over the last half an hour, I saw that there were two accounts, and I quickly asked about the second account, which is a money management account, a market account, and does the State Board of Investment really want to become a banker operating on an interest-bearing checking account? And they said they do that. So I was able, in my mind, to establish that's fine. But I do have a problem with the first section. I understand the problem, and I commend the city for stepping up to address it. But I guess I'm concerned that once we start doing this, are we creating a fiduciary responsibility through PIRA that we cannot unwrap? And my question got to be in line 1-5, the last line on that says that Public Employees Retirement Association must. And then I go down to line 115 that says the city may. Well, you start going between the word must and may, and I guess I'd refer maybe to my friend Representative Simon, is doing this, creating a fiduciary responsibility to PIRA, are we stepping in as a parent to manage their money, and if the money isn't contributed year after year, and if Duluth does not act responsibly financially, have we now inserted ourselves into this problem? And so I began to look at where in this agreement was there an opt-out for PIRA. Where in this agreement that would it say that PIRA is merely acting as a facilitator and is not acting as an agent nor a fiduciary. And that's the elephant in the room. And as you mentioned that, Mr. Chairman, and we talked about yesterday, there is a compounding that's going to go on these liabilities, and there's multiple cities that are going to do it. And it seems to me that the bill probably needs to be a bill that establishes the criteria that when the city of Duluth comes to PIRA, they apply to the PIRA board, and the PIRA board says, okay, we'll help you with this, but here are the new rules of the game. You'll deposit the $12 million, you'll begin to deposit X number of dollars over the next series of months, and we want to look at what your future benefits are going to be, and we'll help you out of this problem. Now, I'm bringing that to you because if you knew Sarah, like I know Sarah, Sarah's my youngest daughter, and several times Sarah has come, Dad, you got to help me out. They're shutting off my phone, and they're shutting off the utilities. And I just go, oh, no, I can't do it again. But adult daughters are different. Again, you can't ground them. And so finally I get to the door and say, okay, Sarah, I'll do it again. I'll do it again. But here's the new rules. If I'm going to step in and assume not only the agency responsibility, but this consciousness thing, I have to know that you're going to perform in a way that allows me to help you. I can't help you if you don't allow me that benefit. And I think I'm hearing that Duluth is wanting to help the situation, and I commend you for being here. But I just think we're one step ahead. I think we ought to get some rules established by PIRA and some regulations that says, okay, if we're going to start doing these and they're going to start coming in, let's set the ground rules first so that they come in as a willing participant. PIRA assumes this agency role as a willing participant, and both can opt out, and that this is not the first step of the state assuming the responsibility for $300 million.
Representative Pearson, I would like Mr. Shepard to address your question on the must in May and give his analysis of it, because I think you have raised an excellent point, and I would hope that as this bill proceeds, that this discussion takes place on two levels. One, for the city of Duluth, but the overall issue is, of course, the state of Minnesota and all of those accounts and what we need to do. So with that, Mr. Shepard, can you address the issue that Representative Peterson brought up?
Mr. Chair and Representative Peterson and members, just some quick thoughts because I really hadn't thought about this in depth. And Mary Bannock, the executive director of PERA, is here and could perhaps comment on how she views this. Just on the narrow question that you raised, Representative Peterson, it doesn't appear to me that it would necessarily harm the bill if that first must were a may, because I think that PERA intends to do this. Unless that would cause some type of a GASB problem that I'm not aware of, I think I would probably, in my view, I don't know what Representative Huntley thinks, work if the must said may.
Representative Peterson.
Here's my issue. With different professions in this state, i.e. attorneys, real estate brokers, all those companies, they assume a liability because they are acting in a role for a client. They're acting as an agent of having advanced knowledge and perfection in an industry. And I would assume that once the state steps in, PIRA and or the Board of Investments, do they not take on this mantle of having this grand knowledge that can help correct this problem? And what I don't see in here is some requirement on the part of the city of Duluth to some kind of a performance standard that makes them appear a partner, not a responsible party. That's this great fear that I have.
First and foremost, let's see, we have someone here to address the issue, and we're getting a little toward the end of our time. But I would like to move the bill forward, if we could, and continue these discussions. Remember, the motion is to send it to local government and metropolitan affairs, so this bill's got a long ways to go.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and be specific to the question, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair and members, Mary Bannock, the director of PERA, and we appreciate Representative Peterson's comments. I would point out that in the language on line 118, it addresses that the Public Employees Association may establish other terms and conditions for participation in the fund. We viewed this bill as really our opportunity to establish some rules and procedures for the administration of these types of accounts. They will be held separately from our pension accounts. They will be accounted for separately. If a city chooses not to put any money into an account with us, we have no fiduciary duty. There's no money there to manage, and we don't view this as us being liable for any costs associated with the post-employment benefits that have to be paid for out of this account. We're simply a record keeper. We're taking the money in, notifying Mr. Bicker's staff what's to be invested, and keeping track of the earnings on it and issuing checks when payments are required or requested by the city. If there's comfort, and I'm sure our board would have comfort in adding some fiduciary language in this as we move forward in the process to specifically identify that issue, that would be welcome. But we otherwise are not uncomfortable with playing this role.
Representative Peterson?
Then I guess I would like to see some language that allows you to opt out. That the PERA can in fact step out of this role, because they're going to try to modify behavior, and in order to do that, you need to say, enough, we're not going any further, we're going to get out. And if you don't have that kind of ability, you're not going to modify behavior.
Representative Peterson, I think you've made an excellent point. Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A quick follow-up question. Maybe direct this to Mr. Shepherd or to PERA testifiers, but are there other examples of PERA acting in a sense as a trustee for these types of accounts? And I know that in a private trust account, a trustee is potentially liable for failing to diversify investments and not delivering an adequate performance for the investment made. And the question I have is that kind of trustee role one that you already play? Is it something that is commonly done or done in other sections of Minnesota state government, or is this a new issue that doesn't have a well-defined series of roles and responsibilities?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Howard Bicker. I'm Director of
the Investment
Board. So from the investment perspective, the board invests for a number of entities. We don't just do pension stuff. We invest for a number of endowments and state agency accounts and whatnot. So what Duluth is requesting is not dissimilar to some of the other things that we already do. But is in the provisions in 1.22, we are having this money invested in 11A.14, which is a bunch of pooled accounts, some of which, where the Duluth money will be going, is non-pension money. We cannot commingle this with pension-related assets, so we have to keep them separate. For legal purposes and tax purposes, we give them three investment options. They know those options in advance, and in fact, Duluth will have to set what asset allocation and what risk parameters they want going in.
I'm sorry, could you repeat your last name? The committee.
Howard Bicker.
Okay, thank you very much. Representative Broad.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, and I appreciate your willingness to allow these questions to come forward. I think Representative Peterson, as you suggest, raises some very, very, very good questions, and they were very well communicated. And not that you all woke up this morning saying, I want to make Laura feel better today, but it certainly would make me feel better today to change that must to a may. Just giving this committee, I think, a say. I don't sit on local government, and I don't sit maybe on some of the committees as this bill goes forward, and I certainly think that the disparity between the must in one section and the may in the other is worthy of our attention.
Representative, you want to move that?
Please.
All right. Representative Broad moves that on line 1.5, delete the word must and insert the word may. Any further discussion to that? Seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. Is there... Yes, Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, I know that you want to move this forward, but I would also feel more comfortable, since I'm not on local government, that we actually carry this forward until our next meeting so we have an opportunity to explore some of the concerns. Because this is bigger than Duluth, and I commend them for trying to get a handle on the problem, but it isn't just limited to their area, and I'd like to have some more time to discuss this
before
we move it forward.
And I understand your concern. We are going to be revisiting this issue. This isn't going to be the last bill on this particular topic dealing with pensions before this committee. So while this is a local bill, and usually the custom of the body is that we allow local bills to move forward on a local issue, but it has immense ramifications on the statewide issue. So I think we have an opportunity here for a win-win, that Duluth gets to solve its problem and we can use their bill as a vehicle for helping us with our statewide problem. So I would prefer, members, that we honor the custom and usage of the House and we allow a local bill to move forward. And we will be revisiting this issue. We're not done with it. Representative Peterson.
Again, I really want to commend Duluth for coming forward on this. It is a monster, but it is. You start eating it one bite at a time.
Representative Peterson, I greatly appreciate your comments and analysis on this issue, and we're going to count on you in the future on this one. Just so you know. I'm going to renew my motion that House File 163, as amended, be recommended to pass to Local Government Metropolitan Affairs. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members.
You're welcome. Meeting is adjourned.